Welcome back to Off the Dope and Out the Crazy House with Anthony Ray. You are now listening to Anthony Ray. And the good news is that we made it. One more year down here to make things better. It's a chance. So I am glad that you came. And the reason why I'm probably talking, I might sound a little different to you. I don't know, I feel different. It's because right now I'm just in the room and I'm just laying on the bed and just talking into the phone. I would usually do this like sitting up and have more energy, but this shit, you know, at this time, I'm in a relaxed state for some reason, and I just felt like chopping it up with y'all. I was gonna lay it down, and I had something on my mind I wanted to speak to y'all about. So while we're on the topic of the new year, before I get into what I want to talk about, I want you to take this number and think about it. So from May of 2020 to April of 2021, almost 100,000 American individuals died of drug overdoses, which is a record high in America. More people died in that year, in 2021, and that's only up to April, right? But that's that year span from May of 2020 to April, the end of April 2021, that year saw the most deaths by drug overdose than any year in American history that's been recorded. So to those of you who are listening right now, you are blessed. You are blessed beyond measure. There's a reason right there. You could have easily caught the bad dope and you didn't. I always talk about second chances, but you don't know how many second chances you had last year. And some of you might have a good idea of it, because people around you might have been dying. But for some reason, here you are, trying to figure out how to stop amidst record numbers of people dying off of the things that you want to stop. Think about that. Think about that. When I think about it, you know what I think about? I think about the fact that I'm blessed that I felt like I got hid away and protected. Like I got hid in a bad situation to be removed from a worse one. That's how I feel. They hid me away in the crazy house for some reason, to protect me, from the world. Hid me away in a hole in the wall jail cell. It protected me. I got clean before record-breaking deaths would occur. Fentanyl running rampant and tearing people down in the streets. And this is not over-exaggeration. Fentanyl, cocaine, and heroin were the top three culprits of those 100,000 deaths in that year. I was using opioids in my life, you know, in my past. I was using cocaine. I would pop four bars. And I'm blessed. You know, my brother even stopped, you know, and chilled out just in time. So think about that. And don't take it lightly, because it's real. So while we talking about reasons, what I want to share with you today is something that's a bit strange to some, and for others it's going to be enlightening. But this is just how I kind of am. But before I begin this, I want to say that what I'm about to say is my opinion. I'm not going to reach out on a limb and tell you that God told me to tell you this or any of that stuff, because none of that's true. I just think that what I have to say might help you. And I came to these conclusions pondering, and some of them, I'm not going to lie, it just kind of came to me. It just made sense. So I'm not trying to seem like I'm trying to, you know, be anything mystical or anything like that. What I want to do is I want to try to give you clarity as to why I believe we are here. Now, why does that have anything to do with sobriety? Because purpose has to do with sobriety. Having a reason and knowing why we exist, or what's going on down here, why are we here, is integral, is an integral part of life and existence, period. Because knowing why, it gives you reason, and that reason can help you go on, and it can affect the way that you behave while you go on. So this is just my opinion. So don't take this as Holy Ghost truth, or go out and start a cult behind it, or just think about it and take it into consideration. If it makes sense, then mull it over your brain. But this is why I think we were put here on earth. You tell me if you think this fits. So we got to think about what the earth is and how it works. So on earth, if you think about earth, most people believe that the earth is hell. I've heard a lot of people say earth is hell. I don't believe that's true. In all of the NDE, near-death experiences that I've listened to before, of people who've had those experiences of almost dying and coming back, their pictures of hell all rolled together were, they varied a little bit, but most of them had to do with complete darkness, it being cold, far from love, warmth, and sort of like a void. Sometimes it was a void. So there was no top, bottom, you know, there was no floor, ceiling. It was just a void, darkness. Like they say, space is outer space. A void. And they didn't stay there long. They had to figure something out that brought them out the void. But it wasn't hell to be here. It wasn't hell. What I believe we are doing down here is that this is actually closer to what would be considered a jail or prison, because it's pretty large, right? And before you go, whatever, like, I want you to think about the fact that everything on earth is held down to the ground. They say gravity, or some people say density or weight. But everything on earth is held downward. But the way out of here is to go up. So something doesn't want us to be up there. And the distance between down here and up there is a long, long way. Not only that, but as you go higher, the air gets thinner. The higher you get, well, that's the way out. When you get to the other side of the earth, the outside, when you get outside of the earth, they say there is no air. We need air to breathe. It seems to me to be a warning. The air gets thinner as you go up, and then there is no air outside of the earth. They also say there's a radiation belt around the earth as well, a band of radiation. Well, we don't do too well in radiation. The human body seems to be another barrier. Think about this also. All right. Even if you got off the earth, everything is so far away that by the time you get there, there'd be no use, because you'd be gone or starved or half starved, only to reach a place that doesn't have any reason, that you have no reason to be there anyway. There's no life there. It doesn't facilitate our life very well. It wasn't meant for us. And this goes on for millions of miles, of light years and miles, whatever, before you can find another place that's inhabitable, according to the people that are telling us that we have to rely on. Because we don't know ourselves, but even according to their own data, this is what we're looking at. So their focus is out there, but all signs show that something doesn't want us out there. And what would be the purpose? You see, I think that there was actually, once again, a very, very intelligent design in this whole thing. See, people always say there was no intelligence. This is all amazing. I don't care what nobody says. I don't care what they tell you. I don't care how they pretend that it makes no sense, that this whole thing is throwed. But amazing. So think about this. If you, let's say we know, most of us know we're spirit inside of here. We animate this suit, right? And so we're spirit. Now, what is the only entity that doesn't need air and can travel long distances without the need of a vehicle? A spirit. A spirit. It's my thought that what actually happened was this. Let's say that we are spirits and we're in outer space, right? We're in outer space. Okay? Flying around, zooming from place to place. We're doing whatever we want. You're a spirit. All right? But just like everywhere else, there are always laws that govern the way things work. Just like down here, there are much, much more laws. Okay. but there are even laws that govern the spiritual world. So let's say as a spirit, you break a universal spiritual law of some sort, some cosmic, galactic, you know, law or whatever. Something we don't know about because we don't know those laws. We don't operate in that world. Stay with me. If you were to try to punish a spirit, how would you punish it? How could you make it sit down for a minute like you do out here? How could you? It's a spirit. You can't hold it. I mean, you can't stop it. Like, what could you do? You could put it in a body. You could force it into a body. The body would contain it. That's what I believe happened. So we're basically given a life sentence. I think that's the reason why the overarching tone down here is somewhat dreary and sometimes negative, because maybe we're like spiritually negative, you know, we're kind of criminal-ish down here. I also believe that might be the reason why when the first inhabitants of Earth were here, it's the first inhabitants of the planets are here, it's always very, very, very hard life. It's a hard sentence. It's a hard sentence. Now, as time progresses, it's just like other places. You find a way to make life better. It slowly progresses, but the first spirits that were here had a rough go. And I believe that to be because of the sentencing. See, if you as a spirit, everything that you are used to doing, you can't do here because the heavy laws that govern this place. The laws that govern what they're saying is gravity or density. Well, you're used to being lightweight and free, zipping through the cosmos, doing as you please. But down here, there's more laws and everything's heavy and your body won't allow you. Down up there, you're not afraid to die. Down here, you're always thinking of death. Or death is always on its way. You, matter of fact, you're always slowly dying. As you grow, you die. So you have to be aware of it. Whether it's from the danger or just life itself or your choices, death is always around the corner. So it's a different life, because down here, so it's just like your five senses. The five senses down here are also like a governor. Like you put a governor on a vehicle. So that car can only travel 120. But you take the governor off and it can zoom 200. But it has to stay within the limits because of the laws that restrict it. So your five senses are that way too. For each different species or animal or whatever it is, they were given different laws to govern what they are. And those are the five senses. But the five senses also free you, yes, to experience this whole situation in a certain way. But they also, because many people think the fact that we came down here in order to have this great experience. Well, when people speak of their near-death experiences, this is the part that trips me out. In most of those near-death experiences, what happens when they leave the body is that they actually experience more. You see what I'm trying to say? So why would you, if as a spirit, when you leave your body, you experience more color, more sight, more sound, more feeling, more everything, more knowing. There's more. Why would you go into a body for experience? when your experience is limited here to what you can taste, touch, smell, see, and hear. The five senses of this kind of limit you. Now, I still do believe that no matter where you are, it's real to you. Some people say that spirits or the ghosts and all these things, they don't. It just depends. I think ghosts are different from the spirit, so they have different experiences. But wherever you are, to you, it's a real experience. Just like when you dream in a certain way, it's real. I can feel things in my dream. I shook someone's hand in a dream the other day and stared them down. Like, I could feel the hand in my hand. Wherever you are is real to you. That's your experience. So the five senses, what they do is they trap us here. They make it so real that you can't escape it. The only way out of this suit, right, is to be taken from it. You know how they say, when it's your time, it's your time. Very reminiscent of jail. I believe that there's a part of us that it draws from the other side, memories of the other side. So some of the concepts and the things that we do, they're not new. They're not new. We draw those concepts from concepts that had already been created. There were concepts that were outside of this time, outside of this, and we just somehow, it's like a remnant of something we once knew. You know, like the thought of a waiting room. Well, people said a waiting room was already in existence, because they talked about, you know, Sheol, or they talked about, you know, waiting in purgatory. These are waiting rooms. It's the same thought process used in a different way, but still, that's the concept of it. So in our head, we say things that make sense, but nobody thinks above them all the way. So when it's your time, nobody can change your time. That's because they say the date that you're gonna die is set, and no man can change it. Even the near-death experiences, right? In the near-death experiences, you can go look up some yourself. Most of them that came back, they were told what? Y'all already know. What were they told when they died and went up there? And they wanted to stay, but they got told, it's not your time. It's not your release date. No man can change that. It's set. It's set. I think it's also why people say that the good die young. I think it goes back to that having a remnant of things that we knew once, because the good die young doesn't mean that the person as a sentient human being down here on earth, as an earth dwelling inhabitant, was necessarily a good person when they died young, because bad people die young too. I think what it probably stemmed from was our knowledge of the fact that good souls, so souls that got sentenced to be here, the souls that got sentenced to be here and inhabit this body because of something that they did or whatever, they were sentenced to be here, they weren't that bad of a soul. It's spirit wise, they didn't break that big of a rule. They didn't do that much to be put here in the first place. Therefore, their time here is shorter. Now, how they live out their time here is totally different. I think that has to do with things too, because they also talk about committing suicide. Now, why would committing suicide be wrong? Now, most people know this innately. Matter of fact, it's hard to kill yourself. It's not easy. by most people's accounts, it's an act of desperation, or it's for some, it even takes planning and courage. I'm not glorifying it either, y'all. I'm just being honest about my knowledge of the situation of suicide, which is a big deal because there's different kinds of suicide. I'm not talking about the long range suicide, which many of us actually, as addicts, those who were addicted, because I'm not an addict anymore. That's my belief. But for those of us who were addicted, and for some of those who are addicted and on their way to not being addicts anymore, at some point we were committing slow suicide. Very slow, but it's still suicide. Now, why is suicide wrong? We knew it was kind of wrong in our hearts. It's hard for people to even do it to themselves. It's like something in you doesn't, it knows. It's not the easiest thing somebody can do. Most people do it with a broken heart. It takes a certain level of just giving up, or for others, it's a longing, actually. A longing, a desire to be out of here. Why is it considered wrong, though, by most accounts? I think it's because it would be considered escape. It's like escaping jail. Because the only way to truly leave the earth, this is my opinion, is not by spaceship and all that, even though I believe those things are probably legit in some form or fashion. I just don't know how, because of the things it doesn't matter. But I believe that there are things that exist outside of it. But what I'm saying is the earth itself and humans, the only way that we really leave here and make sense of leaving here, where it makes sense, is as a spirit. You see, if you want to go colonize the moon and all that, you be my guest. I mean, I'll be gone before, most likely before any of that, you know, becomes to full fruition. You know, it's going to be years and years and years away, maybe decades. Who knows? That's going to be a while. But what is the point? They just want to escape it. They want to escape they want to escape the warden put us away, and they want to escape. Which is natural to want to escape. That's a natural desire. When I think about the earth, I kind of feel that way. Like, I've never been in love with the thought of it all. I have great days, as I've always I've shared this with y'all, that I have great days where I'm up, and other days where it's like I just remember that I'm not in love with this place, and I gotta shake that feeling and try to get right, you know. Staying positive is the way to do whatever you're gonna do. Staying positive is actually, and staying not unbothered, but staying focused on doing things that were mentally and physically challenging is what keeps you sane. You got to think about the things that you do when you're in jail. For those of you who've been in jail, especially those of you who have been like me and been in solitary confinement of some kind, whether it was in a mental institution or it was in a jail or prison, God forbid, a prison, right? Of some sort, a cage of some sort. Whenever you were there, whether you put yourself in there in your room and you got high so much that you were so paranoid, you stayed in your room. The only things that keep you sane, think about the things that kept you sane. That's important these days. We gotta stay sane. We living in a world full of people who are losing their minds. People don't act the same. They don't think the same. People think right is wrong and wrong is right. I mean, that's always been kind of a thing, but these days, if you really peep how people think, it don't make sense. It's twisted in some kind of way. How could you possibly think that that's okay? Not saying any of us is better than the other, but it's just, especially not me. I'm just saying, like, there's no way I can do certain things and think that it was okay. I can't justify it even in my own mind. But there are people out here who can do the most foul thing and turn it and make it like if somebody else did it to them and justify that in their mind and make it real. Like we talk about all the time, the delusional. But see, part of this has to do with this too, because what made me really realize this too is that, think about the fact that just being here on earth can cause some people to go mad. Think about that. Just being here. They say everyone has some form of mental instability. Just being here can drive you mad. Just the process of life. Now, if we were totally symbiotic with the surrounding area, meaning the stories that they tell us is exactly how it happened, why would we be here? Why would being here slightly throw you off a little bit? The average individual. And there are some crazy people. I mean, even kids are kind of zany, you know what I mean, in their own way. Yeah, I said zany, but it's the only word I could think of, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like they're crazy, but they're not, you know, they're different. Kids be different in an innocent kind of way. They're not even meaning to. They just being naturally the way that they connected to the environment. That's how they are at first. As time progresses, you can see the change on our mind, how we get heavier and less, you know, less magical, less, I don't know, less imaginative in some cases. It's just the way that the world affects us. So if we're meant to, if this was, not saying we're not meant to be here because we're here, and I'm going to get to the point, because there's a bright side to this. It's not like just because it's jail doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. Just because it's jail don't make it hell. You know, so many people want to try to compare the two. You don't know that shit. See, people think this is hell because they're so, I think that it goes back to knowing that you're a spiritual being. So that you are not even a spiritual being. You are a spirit, mostly. It's mostly what you are. You know, basically wind, you know what I mean? Like a sentient type of wind or something like that. You're that. So being down here to you is heavy. So you might feel like hell, plus all of the struggles and things. But the strange thing about this prison down here, this earth cell, this prison, is that even though we are forced to be here, right, and for some of us we are forced to recycle, I believe that this place is actually rehabilitative. When you take all of the lessons you learn, everything here teaches you. See, the one of the laws they put down here that helps to teach the greatest lessons is the law of karma. Law of reciprocity and all that. You reap what you sow. That's a great lesson to be learned in everything we do. And I'm always looking for karma. Not just because I'm looking to avoid her, But I'm also looking to, I say her, but you know, somebody get offended by that because of what they say karma is. But I'm not trying to avoid it. I'm looking for the lesson, right? So when things happen to me that I think are fucked up, I try to think back to, did I do that to somebody ever? It's kind of like a second thing now. Like, after I get mad, you know what I mean, and I get in my feelings, like, man, I know this dude didn't just, you know, I think in my head, like, did I deserve that long distance? You know what I mean? Like, did I, in a long distance type of way, did I deserve that? Did I do that 3 years ago? It might be a long time ago. I've counted some of my karmas, y'all, and it took years to get. Sometimes it could take years for karma to come back around, and sometimes it could take seconds. The question is not how long does karma take. It's how long does it take for you to recognize that it was karma. That's the real question. Because if you can't even recognize what it is, it has no effect. The lesson doesn't affect you. See, we talk a lot of times about these people who are very selfish minded. And we all know what we call them, you know? And these people, the problem with them is that they don't learn. They can't see karma. Y'all realize, you know, the people we call a narcissist, they can't see karma. You know how I know they can't see karma? Because I brought this up to them. It's the self-awareness is really low. The entitlement is so high, and the lack of discipline and all of that is so, it's obliviousness. It's like dragging a flaming sword behind you as you walk forward. You know, you're just walking. You're not even looking behind you. You're just dragging this flaming sword behind you and just cutting up and burning everything that you pass. But you can't smell the smoke or see the remnants of what you've done, because it's just behind you. Because you always moving forward and not looking back and pressing forward and keeping your eyes on what you got going on, and you know, not letting nothing hold you back. Like, and I'm just talking noise, but because that's what they kind of tell you. But that's what they create. They're creating that selfish person who's only focused on themselves. So if you're only focused on you and not on how you affect everything else, then you can't see karma. You can't. You got to look how it's all intertwined. And some of it is actually hard to deal with. You know? Some of it is actually hard to deal with. That's why I tell people this too. It's the more you go through, the more understanding of others you should be. Here down here, what we really believe is that the more we go through, the less shit we should take from people. That's partially right. Because, you know, being naive can get you fucked up too. But you should have a level of understanding. There's a level of understanding that comes with going through things. So you should be able to put yourself in that person's shoes who makes a mistake, as opposed to being super mad at them for making the same mistake. See, I meet people all the time. They make the same mistake somebody else just made, and they can't believe that that person made that mistake. You did, you, bro. And then when you show them, oh, they be like, oh, okay. But I think that being down here, actually working in that system, if you can see it, It's actually rehabilitative. So many people had their near-death experiences actually say that they realized how everything that they did led up to other things, and how their actions were connected into other actions. You know, like they saw it, how they affected others. They could see the reason why other people acted the way they did. They could feel the way other people felt and why they felt that way, even if it was towards them. So it's a greater understanding on the other side too. Like, you get to step back and really look at the whole picture of what you just did, the whole movie, you know, from the producer's chair, with them explaining it over, you know, like over the subtitles and all that, like this part right here where, so you get to understand it all in your time down here. But you live pretty much down here. I mean, it's such a big facility. There's no reason to have guards. It's its own self-contained holding place. And only way you can be released is to be released from this here. And when you're released, I believe that almost every culture believe the same thing. So you get released, and I think that when you get released from here, you might go to something like a board. Same thing. They used to say they weigh out your heart and all that. But basically, they just see how you lived your life down here. If not, you come back and do it again. Try to escape too early, you come back and do it again. I mean, it's not all bad. But this is just my, once again, disclaimer. It's just my thoughts. This is what I believe it to be. Now, why do I think it's important? I think it's important for the same reason it's important to know that you're in jail when you're in jail. Like, the way people move in your thought process determines on whether or not you're gonna actually get out. You know, everybody has different goals when they're in jail. And you can tell by the way that people behave, in the way that they think, in the way they move, as to whether or not they plan to be free when it's all said and done. See, some people in there don't plan to be free. They plan to just make a name and do it all over again. Sooner or later, they'll be back, because that's what they tell people. We'll see you again. And certain people are like that, as when they leave in jail, somebody is bound to tell them, I'll see you in a little bit. But I'm going to tell y'all something, and it's the truth. When I went to jail, they told me, don't come back. You're not supposed to be here. At the time, I thought in my head, I said, how could that be true if I'm already here? But I didn't say it, though. Because honestly, I agree with him. How you maneuver this life is important. So I hope that I made it clear that even if this is a jail, right? Let's say I'm right. That don't mean for you to go out here and, you know, either act a fool or, you know, try to end your life. That, no, don't do that. Please don't. What I'm saying is, for me, knowing that this might be the case, how I live does matter. Just doing my time, right? Trying not to violate others or be violated. And keeping my eyes on my release date. See, one of the problems that people have, I believe, in this world is that we have all, for some reason, we so concerned with living that we don't think about death or dying. One day we gotta die. There's actually a book of the Bible that they took out, right? It's called the Book of Ben Sira. And in the Book of Ben Sira, I believe that's the book, or it's in the book of wisdom. They took that one out too. It's in one of those. It's either in Ben Sira or the book of wisdom. It says, always think about your death and you will never sin. That's what it says. Always think of your death and you will never sin. It also says in the Tai Chi Ching, if you think of your death, if you aren't afraid to die, is what it says. If you're not afraid to die, then anything becomes possible, right? But it doesn't coax you to do it. It's just saying that if you view death in a certain way, then it makes life, it opens up the possibilities to life if you stop fearing the death. But not fearing death actually takes for you to actually become accustomed to thinking about your own death, to accepting that it's coming. And for me, when the time is right, I guess I await it with anticipation, in a positive way. I mean, not that I want to go anytime soon or anything, but I mean, I'm doing my time, you know. And while I'm here, I plan to leave my mark on the world and to better, you know, utilize my time while I'm here to become a better version. I don't even want to say that. I almost said that, y'all. I'm telling you, we all susceptible to this shit. I'm no different. But I want to better myself. The same way I did when I was locked up in any given time. The same way I tried to do when I was locking myself in a room. Didn't have to be a mental institution or jail. Sometimes it was just locking myself in the room, just like I am now. I'm always in some form of solitude. But in order to stay sane, you got to do certain things. And just remember that we are doing time. Your child is doing time. That's crazy to think about, but your child too. We got to teach our kids how to stay sane. That is important. It's not just about mental health. That's like an all-encompassing word that we use, but actually say it like it is, man. How to stay sane in a crazy world. And part of that is knowing that why we're here. So many people ask me questions about what was it like when I was in the military, and, you know, what was it like in Afghanistan, or you know, whatever, this or that, whatever, right? And how did you do it? Or, you know, some people might think, okay, well, you was in a mental institution. How did you stay sane, like, around all them crazy people 24/7? Or you was locked in a hole for all them months. Like, how did you stay sane? And people that have worse experiences and did way more time in solitary or something like that than me can vouch for this. And, you got to keep your eyes on your release at the same time. I don't know about keeping, I don't mean it that way. You just got to know in your heart that one day you'll be released, right? And I didn't take it one day at a time like they told me, right? I just let all them days meld together and just kept doing the things that I knew was for the best. So I kept my days of activities. My day was filled with activities that were good and positive. Because I didn't, there was only a few things I could do. On top of that, your brain can adapt to anywhere you're at. It can adapt. We've all adapted to being here. So that's part of what the crazy is, I believe. It's just our way of adapting. You know, our way of coping. And I'm sure that some psychoanalytical professional can tell you those things are true, that we do use some of these mental problems, or well, some of these mental problems are just a manifestation of us trying to cope. If your brain trying to cope with all of this. But the main thing is to just remember that one day you get released. The main thing is to try to prepare the future for those that are coming behind us, because, you know, they gotta be here too. And I really don't have much more to say about that. I know this one's kind of strange, and I might not even want to release this one. I guess I'm gonna do it though. It's just, this one seems a little different than all the rest of them. But once again, I tip my hat to the 100,000 people who lost their lives in the past year. And I want us to all just remember them, because it could have been me, it could have been you, but it's not. And I'm just hoping that out of all of this stuff that I said, that you take a few things home. It's just that you got to learn your lesson. Learn your lesson. And once you've learned your lesson, it becomes so much easier to quit. I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm not. I'm not asking you to be perfect. What I'm saying is, one day you can actually be changed. And that's all it really takes. It doesn't take perfection. It just takes a change. I hope that makes sense to you the way it makes sense to me. And just keep pushing. Keep pushing. And one day, you know, we'll all be free again. Just make sure that whenever you do get free, that you've learned your lesson. So, peace and paper. Goodbye. Welcome back to Off the Dope and Out the Crazy House with Anthony Ray. You are now listening to Anthony Ray. What's good? What's up with it? Hope you everybody's out there is all right. As always, I do appreciate y'all for stopping through and chilling with me for a little bit. As always, I want to talk today, just to hop right into it, about more about fentanyl and meth. I've been doing more research on it, and I know that seems kind of strange coming from somebody who decided to do a podcast on addiction, but, and someone who has had a lot of experience when it comes to addiction, for me to have done research on it. But to some of us out there who are actually addicted, it's not that strange, really, because a lot of people that do drugs just do it. Don't really look into what they're doing. Don't even really take deep stock and inventory into the thing that they're gambling with. You know what I mean? And that was me. I didn't even really pay attention. I used to tell people, they used to try to get me to learn more about like how to properly, evenly burn the meth in the bowl and all this different stuff, how to like hot rail the right way. I'd be like, man, don't make me a good user. I used to always say that. Don't try to make me a pro. Because I knew in my head even then that if I became immersed in perfecting this craft, quote unquote, then I was gonna go all the way. The way my mind is the same thought process of people trying to get you to learn more about becoming a prisoner. So they tell you what it's like, and so in my mind I was like, man, don't try to make me like the best user I can be. Even then, I think I was a little more worried when it came to meth, because I liked it so much. And So many people had warned me about it. So I never really did the research. So now I'm really doing the research because I need to know more. I'm driven to know more. So here's kind of what I found. Now, some of this stuff you might know, and some of this stuff you might not know. It just depends on the type of person you were when you began, or the type of person you become after using or while you're using. But it's interesting. And much of this information I'm going to give you came from by way of YouTube researching. So I ended up running into this one guy kept popping up, and his name is Sam Quiñones, I think, or Quiñones. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it's spelled Quiñones. And he's a journalist and a book writer. And he was writing about the fentanyl and meth and how in today's societies they've somehow mixed to create homelessness. And I started to listen to him. So I also looked up the history of amphetamines and the history of meth, and came to find some very interesting stuff. And as I suspected, it turns out that, you know, the government, of course, not just our government, but other governments like Germany, actually helped to create this. Now, as most of us already know, some of the things we do know about meth, and most people do know today, is things like Hitler used to be a heavy user of methamphetamine. His whole time he was doing his thing, he was high on meth. A lot of people know that. What a lot of people don't know is that it wasn't just Hitler. It was also Hitler's soldiers. It was also American soldiers. So they used to actually give, and I believe the kamikaze fighters, they would actually take meth as well, or they were suspected of being given meth as well. So America did the same. America would give its fighter pilots meth, giving them the ability to take longer flights and to fly for, you know, longer periods of time with more focus than other fighters. So it's interesting to see. And so during the first use of meth, of course, it was created by government labs, government people, government scientists. Governmental control was over meth. And that's no surprise. So after the wars and stuff died down, and this is from all the research that I can find, after all those, you know, large scale wars died down, they were left with a large surplus of amphetamine. And they didn't know, they weren't going to throw it away. They weren't going to throw it away. So of course they did what any person with a large supply of something that they don't want to get rid of by throwing it away did it. They said, I'm going to try to sell it to somebody. And they started selling it to the American people. And during that time, they began to market it to Americans as a way to increase productivity. So if you played, I saw one ad a guy put up in one of his slideshows. He was doing a presentation and a lecture on the whole thing, and he showed an ad that was targeted at golfers, and it was saying that if you want to up your golf game, take this. Well, it didn't say methamphetamine. They had a different name for it back then, which I don't remember, but it was meth. It was amphetamines. Or if it was also, you know, targeted towards housewives. And so the housewife, it was like, hey, you want to, you know, basically take the edge off your work. You want to make your day go by more productive. Hey, we got a great fix for you. This stuff, which was meth in a pill form or elixir form. So as you can see, it is the government that trickled this into society, along with large-scale businessmen. Some things never change. So, now, I'm not against business. I'm not against all forms of government, but these two do tend to be the culprits when it comes to fucking over American people and other governments too. So not just American, but these two do tend to be the main culprits. So I'm just throwing that out there. But as time progressed on, of course, you know, more street entities start to get involved because laws start to change. So after a while, they start to learn more about what amphetamines do and what they are. And they say, well, we're going to ban this. We're going to put laws in place that keep people from using this stuff, you know, freely. And whenever you ban something, of course, the underworld takes over. And because people are still going to want what they want. And at that time, I believe they were saying that the biker gang started to take over the use of meth. But meth at that time was more of a, it was more shake and bake, a quicker way to make meth, using very little high-tech equipment, you know, not too much going on there. And it went from that to being used by breaking down, you know, Sudafed and all that kind of stuff that was being done. So they're basically trying to, it was more based in just ephedrine. So after a while, the Mexican cartels, you know, below the American border began to get involved, and they found out a new way to use it. So they kind of perfected what we know as the methamphetamine trade. They found a way to get scientists involved once again. You know, they kind of, like I say, you know, business, large-scale businessmen, which is kind of what the cartel are really, on the underworld side, and government kind of operate the same way. So they kind of took a, it seemed like they took a nod from the government. They got scientists involved, and they found a way that they could not just have to use ephedrine. Because if you have to just use ephedrine, you remember back in the day when, whenever, you know, people were sending people into the store to buy a bunch of Sudafed and all that kind of stuff. I remember, because back then when it occurred, this was prior to me being in the service, maybe right before I went in, I think, 2009, matter of fact, which is a, it's actually, it's 2009 was a big year, because according to Sam, the guy I'm telling y'all about, he said this is when they switched to the new method of meth creation. Because I remember when they started locking up the Sudafed, and I worked at Walmart, I believe, at the time. And at CVS another time. So right after I worked at Walmart, I went to work at CVS as, you know, my way to get money in my pocket. And I remember them locking that up, and I didn't know why. Because see, back then in my community, meth was not the thing. It was cocaine, or it was weed, maybe even ecstasy at that time, or pills, you know. And it wasn't even big on opioids. It was more like meth. I'm not meth. X, we call them XOs, you know, Skittles. It was that. Or it was, you know, coke. You know, of course, alcohol was involved in all of this. Or it was weed. These were the normal drugs around where I was. So I didn't really understand what was going on with the meth and why they were locking up all the Sudafed. You know, but they were like, well, they use it to make drugs. And so now years later, it's like, slow light bulb came on, you know. And so I remember those times, but that was around 2009. So they're saying around 2009, as these guys started to make a different kind, because if you had to find if you had to get a whole bunch of Sudafed, then you started to kind of put yourself on the radar, because they started putting laws in place and tracking mechanisms to figure out who was buying what amount of Sudafed and putting limits on quantities. And so they were playing chess, the cartels versus the government, you know, the street level guys versus the government were playing chess, trying to figure out how to get the stuff moved, and they were adapting to one another. So the cartels got smart, and they said, well, let's scrap the Sudafed. We got to find a way to scrap the Sudafed thing because it's just, it's becoming a hindrance. And so what they did, I believe, was according to what I've studied, what I'm, the information I've gathered, I guess I'd say, it's more accurate to say that, is that they decided that we'll find a new way to make it. And so they found ways to make it from different chemicals that you could find anywhere, like toxic household type chemicals. And this gave them a greater amount of flexibility that they could use in order to make the meth. So now they don't just need that. They could use that, or that. Like, I tripped out when I was in jail and found out that they were cutting some of this stuff with roach spray. And I guess meth is, to me, it was like one of them things where, I don't know, it's something that I really didn't want to know. It's almost equivalent to, but not quite, someone, like they say, wanting to eat the steak, but not wanting to see the cow get his throat slit. You know, like, I was just reaping the quote unquote benefits of the end product of it all. And not really knowing where it came from kind of kept me from worrying too much about it. Because most people would be like, wow, you know, that's got roach spray on it, or, you know, that's got bleach in it or something. You're like, whoa, why, what am I doing? But even then, I couldn't even told you that I would have stopped. You know what I mean? Because when I got out of jail, I still used, you know, even knowing that little bit of information didn't stop it. So they found that way. And during that 2009 year, according to Sam, who was doing interviews with people on the street level, he was saying that the homeless rate started to rise. And so with this new form, which is called P2P. Now, when I say a new form of meth, we're talking like 10 years or more new, you know. But when this new form had came out, which was P2P, which has a scientific meaning. I think they were calling it, let me look, phenyl-2-propanol or something like that is what it actually stands for. So P2P method of making the drug, that it increased people's paranoia and psychosis. So people were going more crazy on the drug. It was stronger. So it was throwing people off at a higher rate. And if anybody knows anything about, if you've ever been through the mental health facilities or through the system, then you kind of realize that there's definitely a link between mental health and homelessness. There's a definite link, because most of the people you're going to come in contact with on that side of the criminal justice, you know, system, or which we'll call the mental health, you know, system as well, they're homeless, because it's hard to take care of yourself when your mind ain't right. It's hard to be regular with the things you do. And being steady, being dependable, and all these things, they have to do a repetitious, you know, steady-minded behavior. And that's not easy for these people who are really dealing with it. And I've actually seen the people that came in there on drug psychosis, including me. I mean, I went in under drug psychosis. So, according to my paperwork, you know. So, I can tell you right now that if I had to, on a daily basis, be in the mindset that I was in at that time, I couldn't do any of this. I couldn't be on here with y'all. There's no way. There's no way. All them voices and, man, there's no way to get no work done. Especially, you know, you got voices in there trying to beat down on your psyche, beat down on your ego, as if you ain't got that yourself, you know, like it ain't bad enough what you think of yourself sometimes. So it turns into a debilitating type of feeling. So when that stuff hit the market, people started becoming homeless. And that's kind of the quick version of what I found out about it. Now, interestingly enough, the fentanyl, which is an opiate, and meth being a stimulant, ended up now, that I guess that's the new version. So they're starting to not only put the fentanyl, and this is words to anybody out there who didn't know this, because most people are connecting the fentanyl epidemic with heroin only, heroin type products only, and coke and cocaine. Because, but what this guy Sam is saying is that they're using fentanyl, which is an opiate, like you would use salt and pepper on steak or anything, like not just steak, on anything. You know how salt and pepper can be used on anything that kind of just to pep the, you know, it's a pepper. That's why I call it pepper, but it's to kind of give it flavor. They're using the fentanyl that way. And the problem is that fentanyl, which was also created in the lab, is synthetic. Just like meth is synthetic. These dangerous, the most dangerous ones are the synthetics, it seems. But they're putting these two together, which an upper and a downer, they used to call that the Belushi ball or whatever, the speed ball. And that's basically what they're creating. And I said in one of these last episodes that I could not figure for the life of me, outside of greed, why would they want to kill their own custodes? Why? Sam Quiñones, or this guy Sam the journalist, he answers this question. So according to Sam, the reasons for them not being concerned with killing off the customers is a few things. Number one, it's cheap. They can make fentanyl by the shit ton because it's cheap to make. It's really, really cheap to make. So they can make as much as they want. The problem with it is that it's super powerful though. So part of the problem might be as well that they're trying to get the mixtures right. So, but they're not, everybody's not a professional chemist, so they don't know how to mix it right. They were mixing it, according to Sam, in speed bullets and doing different things, like, which might not even be the right way to be mixing powders, you know, that settle and do different things. So, but number one, it's cheap. So, you know, number one rule of business is you're trying to cut the cost. You're trying to keep the cost low and the income high. If you're depending on the type of person you are, then you're not even really looking at the quality as you are of looking at the cost of it. Depending. If you can keep customers coming and the cost is low and the quality is low, who cares? You know, that's how some of them look at it. And so that's why, part of the reason why, is just simply because it's cheap. Another reason is they know that it's going to be stepped on. So they make it as heavily as they can from the get-go. And as it goes down the tunnel, it keeps getting stepped on and stepped on and stepped on and stepped on and stepped on. But see, the problem with the fentanyl is it's so strong that I think he was saying that the human body could only take, imagine 2 grains of salt. That's how much fentanyl a human being can literally take before they died. Like, it's that strong. So you should go look this guy up and do your own, you know, research too, because like I said, I've done a limited amount of research, okay? So mine is not, my perspective is not all encompassing, all right? So, but what I'm telling you is not anything that I'm lying about neither. So I'm not going to tell you don't believe me. I believe that what I'm telling you is what I've learned, all right? And so And some of these things, he's not the only one who said it. This was said in other lectures that I listened to as well. So a lot of this information overlaps with what other people have said. But as I said, Sam is just a journalist. And some of these other guys are, you know, in different sides of the story. They might be a chemist or a psychologist or a therapist or something like that. But they might not be all of those things they need to be an expert in everything that has to do with this situation. Because meth is not just one of those categories. It's not a problem in one category. It's a problem. It's a social problem. It's a social problem. It's a mental problem. It's a financial problem. You know, it's many different problems all together. It's an economic, all that. And so it takes some real expertise to kind of like, and it's a business problem. It's a lot going on. So the other thing that they, the other reason why they might not care as much that it's killing people is because it becomes an issue of competition. Whose is the strongest? Who has the strongest product? Also, here's the biggest reason why I think this is me. I think that this is one of the biggest reasons why they don't care. And it's because they can turn a meth user into an opioid user. So we already know that that's saying a lot. Now, a lot of people might think that any type of addict is the same as another type of addict, but that's not 100. That's not true all the way. There's different levels to it, you know. This type of addict is this type of way. That type of addict is that type of way. It tends to be that way. When with opioid use, that need is more physical than it is for an addiction to meth. And that's my opinion along with many others. The physical need for it is there. So it's not just mostly psychological, like meth might be more of a desire, a mental a fixation, a routine that you built up, something that you rely on. But when it comes to opioid addiction, man, you need that in your head. You know, you don't want, it's so painful to be off of it. Your body lets you know immediately, it's not, this stuff's not in me no more. I need it. And if you want me to feel normal, I'm gonna need that. With meth, you know, you're coming down, you get the depression, and you get that lack of esteem, kind of that down feeling, and you need sleep and probably need to eat. And as some people have said in other videos I watched today, that those two things, eating and sleeping, are actually the best thing you could be doing anyway. So why? It's not really a negative. You need that. You ain't been eating nothing. You ain't been sleeping. So that's not even a downside. Your body is just like, give me what you took from me. It's not saying that I need this certain thing or I'm not going to be normal. It's like, now let's get back to normal. The opioid person, the body is saying, I don't want to go back to normal. Don't you dare put me back to normal. How dare you try to make me be normal, man? Let's go and get that stuff and let's stay just like this. Ah, there we go. That's opioid, you know. So if they can turn you into an opioid addict, they have a lifetime guy there. And I think that's one of the greatest reasons right there. And when we talk about the opioid use, I can tell you how strong it is. There's a family, and we'll go off to the side right quick about this. So there's a family called the Sackler family. The Sackler family, this according to Sam, is one of the they are the unofficial heads of Purdue Pharma, a large pharmaceutical company, Purdue. According to Purdue's research, they knew this, by the way. This is prior to the big findings that these companies were, they knew what was going on with the drugs while they were selling it. Well, they dope dealers. We're going to get into this greed thing here in a second. But they knew that 90 days of opioid use equaled 5 years of opioid use. If they could get you to use it for 90 days, they'd have you hooked for 5 years. And that's by their own research. They also paid their, they paid their sales reps, their street teams, their sales reps, the highest bonuses out of everyone in history for selling something that they knew was highly addictive and could possibly kill. And this is something I just listened to today. And if you put this against what I said about the greed of the dope dealer, it matches perfectly. He said that it, he believed that the Sackler family was just as addicted to the money from Oxycontin as addicts were to using the Oxycontin. Ain't that what I've been saying? I'm telling y'all. So they've been known. They knew what they were selling. They knew why. So they knew that if we turn these guys into opioid users, we got a lifetime member. It's dirty. That's cold-blooded. You're going in for an upper. They're giving you a synthetic downer. You're going for a synthetic upper to give you a synthetic downer mixed with it. So you're getting a Belushi ball. Or you're going in for, you know, cocaine, and you're getting them both. And they're hooking you. It's just like they did in the food industry. You know, they said, well, we're going to give you the food, but we're going to also put the MSG in there. We're going to put this, that, and the third in there. And you're not going to know why your mouth watering when you smell this stuff. You're not going to know why. You're not going to have no idea why you eating these foods and it's hard to go to sleep when you get done. Or you're going to go, or you feel sleepy as soon as you get through eating it. You're not going to know. Because we're getting you addicted to not the food itself, but what's in the food. Now, the last reason why they said that they wanted to, or why they didn't care that much about killing their customers, is because, in actuality, part of this is the problem of the addict, the addicted mind, the person with the addicted mind. So when they find out somebody has died on it, they're like, man, that's some good dope over there. That's where we need to get it from. And the businessman having an addicted mind himself knows this. See, I keep telling y'all are dealing with people whose addiction is worse than yours. See, the addict is not the worst of his kind. This is the throwed off part. I'm gonna tell you something. Now, the addict will do some fucked up shit in order to maintain his or her high, right? Their high. Their ability to stay in that state, right? But they aren't, they might, of course, they might steal. We know that. They might even rob. Might sell their body. Some have been even known to sell their children in order to get high. Just saw a girl get convicted over this. Something else I was watching. So they'll do a lot of different things. Definitely known for these theft related type of things, these lacks, the things that kind of drop our morality a little bit, because you want to feel the way you want to feel, and in some cases because your body is telling you you need to feel a certain way, right? But I'm gonna be honest, this is my opinion, and I'm going to say this, but those people who are addicted to money are always known for murder. They're known for murder. When you hear of people who are addicted to money, when you're talking to somebody who's addicted to money, you are talking to somebody who most likely will kill in order to get it. When they really, really love the money. And the music that I've listened to and still sometimes listen to, they'll drop hints of it. You'll see some of these guys, because you got to imagine through the lens. Now, I'm not addicted to money, right? But as I imagine the addiction of money through the lens of addiction, the way I know it, I can imagine that this person probably likes the way that money feels in their hand. They like the way that it smells. The sound. You see what I'm saying? Because a lot of people think that people that are addicted to money are actually addicted to what money does. Nah. They're just like any other addict. They're not, they after a while, at first you're like addicted to what it does. That's like some of the first steps of addiction. It's being addicted to how it make you feel. So when I first, and mind you, I got addicted to cigarettes, right? I was actually at first addicted to the way it first gave me a head rush. Right? But after a while, you're not addicted to that anymore because it don't come the same. You're really not addicted to the same thing that you was at the beginning. Yeah, in the early stages, just addicted to the feeling. As time progresses, you're kind of addicted to the things that are intrinsic to it, like that go along with it. Like with cigarettes, it might have been that I'm not just addicted to the cigarette no more, the head high, because I don't get that no more. I'm addicted to that time off to the side. So my break, I'm addicted to being able to go off by myself and do this thing. Or maybe you're addicted to being around people and doing that thing. It's like a social thing, you know. So you're not even addicted to the feeling anymore. You know, you're addicted to the other parts of it. And then after a while, you're addicted to, it's just a part of your life. You're just addicted to it. It's like being, like, you ever heard the songs where they say married to the money? They're married to the money. When I used to hear that, I didn't think too much about it. But now I'm thinking as an ex-addict, I'm thinking that's saying a lot, because it reminds me, like I've said in one of these other ones, about like my cousin. When I told him fuck heroin, he was like, fuck you. It's the same thought process. They really actually love the money itself, as if the money is an entity. So a lot of times you'll see them have the money on the table. The money's always somewhere in the picture. They rolling it around their arms and rubbing their body with it. They got it in the bag with them all the time. It's just constantly, it's actually the money, not what it does anymore. To them, probably going shopping is like whatever. I mean, what's one more Gucci? What's one more? I mean, one. What's the difference between Gucci and Yves Saint Laurent? Like, what's the difference? You know, it's just a habit at that point that goes along with the money. But the money itself is the what they love. And you're not going to come between them and that. Because if you try to come between them and that, it becomes a real issue, because they see it, like I said, as something that they're married to. And if you look at it on a large scale, think about it. I'm going to tell you how dangerous a person addicted to money is. All right. Our governments are always addicted to money. They're always addicted to money. Wars come behind money addictions. A war come with that. You could put that on a government scale. You could put that on a mafia scale. You could put that on a cartel scale. You could put that on a street level scale. Addictions to money bring, it's like death come with it. Now they'll try to put that on a drug scale, because it's not really the drugs that's doing it. The drug users aren't the main culprits of the killing. It's those that are addicted to the money from selling the drugs that are doing the killing. They have the worst addiction. And I'm going to tell you how bad it is on top of that. Our governments, I just found this out. I'm slow, y'all. You know what I'm saying? In some ways, I guess. I'm slow to the game of some things, right? So I'm just finding out that I didn't know that when a large drug bust takes place, I didn't know that the money that is confiscated from the drug bust goes directly to the unit that does the busting. It's their money. They can incorporate that money into their coffers. So now it makes more sense why there's such a large war on drugs, because these guys are the police ain't doing nothing but hitting licks on they just hitting licks. They hitting licks on drug dealers. So of course they want to bust as many houses as they can, because every single amount of money and drugs they make is more money for them to be able to go do what they need to do. So they say largest drug siege in history. Where did that money go? You think that money went to feeding the homeless or putting a pothole in the street? Hell no. That money went to getting them uniforms, paying for their overtime, giving them bonuses, new cars, new government vehicles, new cruisers, new patrol units, better weaponry, more dope so they can be undercovers and do it all again. You know what I'm saying? So the police are addicted to the money too. The police addicted to the money. Officials addicted to the money. The government addicted to the money. The nation addicted to the money. And that's what creates the killers. It's not just the dope dealer, man. It's not just the drug user, man. It's those who deal heavily in the money. So to them, killing is business as usual. Because there's a side effect to all addictions. And those who are truly addicted to money know that one of the side effects might be a little bit of killing. Now, one of the other things that's going on, according to Sam, is that's causing some of these deaths is that being that they're pushing so much dope now with the new way that they can create it, they've created more dope, more meth. So they push more meth into the game. We'll just say it like that. They pushing more meth into the game. Well, when you push more meth into the game, you get more inexperienced drug dealers. Guys who don't know how to handle the money, how to hide the money, how to even operate in a way that's gonna, you know, equate to longevity in the game, quote unquote longevity. Because, you know, longevity for a drug dealer might be different than longevity for a car salesman or something like that. When you look at it from a certain angle. So they're creating people who not only don't know the game, but don't care. You know what I mean? Like, they don't. So you're dealing with drug dealers who, they're babies to the game themselves in some cases. They just hearing that it's a new wave of way to make money. They know they could take this and make this. But they don't know about cutting it. They're not chemists. They're not none of that. They don't know a lot about it. Earlier in the game, some of these guys, those biker gangs and all that, these guys knew what they were doing. Contrary to popular belief, you know, these guys had a better grasp because they took years to figure it all out. Even the cartels took years to figure out what the hell they were doing with the dope. The people that have gotten it now, this according to Sam, don't know as much. So they make it more dangerous for those who are using. And as I said before, when you're dealing with people who are about that money, they're not going to do a lot of research. Just like when you just got to think about it. Because when you were about the drug, your addiction, did you take a lot of stock into, you know, the other side of the game? You know what I'm saying? It might be the same way with them. You know, they're addicted to one portion of the game more than the other portion. So that's why they tend to not care as much about the dope and make sure that they treat the money right. You're not that worried about your money, and you're making sure that you treat the dope right. And that's how I've seen it. So you got people out there who are broke, going homeless behind the dope. You know what I'm saying? And the opposite is occurring on the other side. They're getting rich, you know what I'm saying, because they're more concerned about the money and they're degrading the dope. It's the opposite effect, showing that there actually are two different addictions going on. I just thought this whole thing was kind of interesting, y'all. That's just kind of what I wanted to bring to y'all. It's, I tried to do it as quick as I possibly could, because I've been kind of bubbling over waiting to say some of this stuff, and there's a lot more to learn, but I just want to kind of shed light on what I have came across so far. And I just want y'all to just to be safe. Like, it's because now that you know, most likely they're going to put fentanyl in everything. And I know that a lot of y'all are just going to adapt to it or in some type of way. But people are out here dying for real, because the two really don't mix. And fentanyl really is deadly and destructive. On top of it all, as Sam Quiñones is pointing out, it does lead to homelessness. When you ain't got your stuff right and your mind ain't right, and you have that addiction on you of some kind, it can lead to a bad place. And so, as always, I just want to encourage you to do the best you can to become better than you were, and to remain that way. And on, in a way, I can't even say become better than you were. I'm kind of encouraging you to go back to who you were before this all began. Because you got to start there. You know what I mean? It's like, not, you don't necessarily have to just become this thing that's like huge. It's like, go back to who you were. Try to remember. Because even though that you might not have been great to you, it was better than the addicted you. And if you start looking at it like there's something that you've never been that you need to aspire to in order to get off the drug, then it might seem as if you're not good enough again. But you already were good enough before. That's still inside of you. It's just got stuff on top of it. It's all it is. You just got to get back to that level of normalcy, the true you, you know, and try to figure out who that is again. And it's not even, I guess you can't even say figure it out. I'm trying to figure out how to put this. It's kind of a complex thing to try to tell you, but I think you kind of get the gist, because you're not going to have to really figure it out. In a way, you're just kind of going to go back to being that, in a way. And then from there, you'll build on it. And I'm not telling you it's going to be perfect or that it's the easiest thing to ever do, because you didn't get addicted overnight. You might not break that habit overnight. Some people actually will, though. Contrary to popular belief, because there is a day where you're going to be doing and there's a day where you're not. If there wasn't, I wouldn't be this far along and be clean. There was actually a day where I was and then I was not. So in a way, it does happen overnight. But maintaining it at first is not an overnight thing. But for the sake of you not having to hear me repeat over and over the things that you already heard, I'm going to just leave y'all with that, and I'm going to just encourage y'all to do those same things that we talk about all the time that'll kind of help you get on that road to maintaining your own, you know, mental stability and health. And I hope that you are out there doing those things, and I can't never ever leave here without letting you know that you should try to stay physically fit and to always work on your hygiene. Keep that up to par. Focus on that. Because one thing that I've learned about meth over this learning period is that they always talk about the meth mouth. Well, most people are saying that the meth mouth is not, it's not a prerequisite for using. It's just a sign that you've gotten too deep into the meth, that you don't care about anything else other than the meth. You don't care about brushing your teeth. You don't care about any of this other stuff. And for some of y'all, you might not have access to those type of things, but try to make it as important. If you don't do nothing else, take care. Because when you get off, you're going to want to still have your teeth. You know, you're going to want to still be in a decent enough form to be able to function. And just take care of yourself, man. And as always, you know, I just want to wish y'all peace and paper. All right, y'all. Goodbye.